You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is October 2nd of 2024, and this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And as we're coming to the one-year anniversary of the start of the Israeli-Hamas war of 2023, it's only fitting that I continue talking about the situation in Lebanon, because there is just a flurry of writing on it. Of varying quality. And there's not a lot of good news as far as being a Zionist is concerned. Some of you may have read that Ben Shapiro is talking about mass transfer of populations, saying that, well, we're Jews, so we can get away with this, trying to make this almost a method of peace. That's very typical of people like him. But to understand the terror tactics used by the Zionist Alliance is central to understanding what's happening there. It was the end of last month that Hezbollah admitted the death of Hassan Nasrallah as a result of a massive attack on September 27th in the Herek neighborhood in South Beirut. Killing many, many people. They just bombed the hell out of the place, hoping that enough important people would be killed that would be justified. They used missiles to level six more or less high-rise buildings, residential buildings, and then they used a one-ton bunker buster meant to shatter the shielding of the Hezbollah headquarters underneath. But, of course, Beirut will never be the same again since then, because nothing will be the same in the Middle East, or at least if you consult your local Likudnik. A lot of people keep talking about triggering full-scale war, even nuclear war. People love making these predictions. But full-scale war is now the norm. Those strikes killed, and these are always very low numbers, roughly 100 people. Since just this week, about 700 have been killed by the Israeli campaign across the country. And the head of Hezbollah has support all over the Islamic and even the non-Islamic world, especially the Slavic world. This is normal military assassination tactics, as if a movement can be stopped by destroying its leader. It is, Hezbollah is a resistance group. It's a political party with a militia. It's extremely popular. It is a resistance movement, of course, and it aims to resist, among many other things, the occupation of Gaza, the West Bank, and Israeli interference in Lebanon and Syria. And especially since the International Court of Justice, despite it not being a court, not being concerned with justice, still, in this case, it's correct and almost institutionalized the rejection of Israeli policy. But institutions don't matter as far as the Jews are concerned. The BlackRock administration running the U.S. Using this unelected zombie of Joe Biden. There's been attempts to bring about some kind of ceasefire, which would end the threat from Hezbollah, from the northern part of Israel. But that's not the case. The threat to Zionism, of course. And as is often the case, when a war involving Israel occurs somewhere else, The West Bank also suffers, despite it not getting much media attention. There was a BlackRock proposed ceasefire in Lebanon, but before Netanyahu even read it or knew what it was, he rejected it. And no matter what Israel does, the regime continues to supply Israel with weapons and money, neither one of which the regime even has, violating State Department rules concerning weapons going to countries that might use them against international law, that is to say, in war crime. But that doesn't matter. And, you know, my view of international law is very cynical. But there have been State Department resignations over all this. There's been substantial international and domestic criticism, but there's very few American politicians that are going to reject the genocide in Gaza, regardless of what happens in Lebanon. The U.S. does hold at least the military key to Israeli success, if not the financial one, because that comes from elsewhere, or could come from elsewhere. But AIPAC and and Shapiro and all of these people hold that only the Goyim are subject to international law. To think that taking out one leader is going to end the resistance to all of this is nonsensical. On this very show, we've talked about the myriad of men who have been executed by Israeli forces. You know, the former Secretary General of Hezbollah back in the early 90s, Mousawi, Ahmad Yassin in 2004, al-Rantiti, murdered in 2004 in Gaza. Of course, we all know about Soleimani in 2020. And more importantly for our purposes, Ismail Haniyeh, murdered by the Israelis in Tehran in July of this year. Most of the men that I've mentioned were closely connected with Hezbollah. My God, we could go back to 1938, the murder of the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, the Orthodox man Antoun Seydi. But this is a way of thought, not a person. The resistance axis can't be reduced to individuals. And this could never go away so long as Israel continues to do what it does. Now, we all know that Israel's planning, at least under the current coalition, although I think it really doesn't matter who's running it, the annexing of Gaza and the West Bank, even South Lebanon, disguising this as a security zone is part of the agenda here. There is an Israeli operation against Hezbollah in extreme South Lebanon, and it follows a normal pattern, whether it be the operation itself or the coverage of it, to ignore the causes of all of this, why this is even going on in the first place, to both ignore and reject any contextual argument, targeting leaders, targeting personnel, and the way that the Israelis present this, of the civilizational warrior against the barbarian Goyim, but Israel being the valiant fighting the savage Gentiles. This region was put together by false and irrational boundaries sketched by foreign powers. The shoddy cartography put this all together, and these fictions tend to keep company with crime, as many have written, ethnic cleansing. About October 7th of last year, Hamas flipped the table. I'm not the only one to note that this did a huge amount of damage, almost as bad as the defeat in 2000 of the South Lebanon Army. But this was an insult to Israel's security apparatus. I don't believe this was known in advance by the Israelis. I think they're simply overstretched. But to the north, there's yet another nonsense border. Once the war began, this particular war began, this is nothing new, of course, this goes back many, many decades. But as far as Hamas goes, in 2006, but recently, Hezbollah, who was involved from the very beginning here, their attacks on North Israel, mostly militarized, have been displaced to southern parts of the country. Far more Lebanese had to be relocated to the north of Lebanon. Last week, we talked of the pager and walkie-talkie murders. This was supposed to be the prelude to a full-scale ground invasion. And you know, it wasn't just Nasrallah who was murdered. There were several others. The organization's Southern Front commander was killed, and a few other more localized commanders. And I don't want to leave out the West Bank. You thought it was bad prior to this time last year. They are demolishing what's left of the Arab neighborhoods, demolishing them with bulldozers and terrorizing the population, constant roundups. Recently, there's been about 1,000 civilian deaths, 6,000 wounded since the war began. That's strictly in the West Bank. And, of course, this is all based on backing by the United States and NATO. Now, as far as Lebanon goes, the walkie-talkie nonsense came after the targeted attacks on Hezbollah and its political military leaders. Once those two steps were accomplished, the third was indiscriminate air and ground attacks using white phosphorus shells. In other words, they're using chemicals and chemical warfare against civilians. Again, nothing is new here, but the media is acting as if they've just discovered some new event. And the celebrations in Tel Aviv are, to say the least, premature. The defense minister, Yoav Gallant, went so far as calling the measure the most significant strike since the founding of the State of Israel. Netanyahu himself thinks that his murder changed the balance of power in the region for years to come. He really thinks that murdering him is going to allow displaced Israelis to return to their homes near the border of Lebanon. And Reuters and a lot of idiots, you know, followed up on this. But his death, again, doesn't really matter. Many of you have come across, although I don't think I've dealt with it at length, the 1985 to 1988 manifesto of Hezbollah, written after the invasion and occupation of Lebanon in 1982. And this is what the manifesto says about Israel. I want to quote this directly here. "We see in Israel the vanguard of the United States and our Islamic world. It is the hated enemy that must be fought until the hated ones get what they deserve. This enemy is the greatest danger to our future generations and to the destiny of our lands, particularly as it glorifies the ideas of settlement and expansion initiated in Palestine and yearning outward to the extension of the greater Israel from the Euphrates to the Nile." Now, I think they have it reversed. It's not the vanguard of the United States. American foreign policy is the vanguard of the Israelis. But otherwise, it's a solid way to approach this. I mentioned in 1992 the killing of the Secretary General Abbas al-Mousawi, as well as his wife and son, by the way. And that's what led to the elevation of Nasrallah many years ago. So they've done this before, and they also tend to make these wildly exaggerated claims as to what the consequences would be. Nasrallah was a formidable leader, both in his own right and who he was able to promote, like Fuad Shukr, who was important in bringing the rocketry, the precision-guided missiles. Don't forget, the Hezbollah is pretty much a regular force. But every time there's an assassination from the Israelis of some high-profile political operative, they all claim that this is some game-changing victory. What happens is that the murdered leader is usually replaced by someone just as, if not more, determined and adept. Another Nasrallah. I mean, clearly they know that there's a target on their backs all the time. So they have a succession already laid out. Don't view these, whether it be Hamas or Hezbollah, as passive actors. They know the Israelis better than we ever could, with intelligence, Hezbollah has been dug in for such a long time, waiting for this, and the Israelis are doing very poorly. I'll talk about that here in a minute. So, yesterday, October 1st, 2024, we saw a barrage of Iranian ballistic missiles hitting targets in Israel, especially around Tel Aviv. It was explicitly in response to the Nasrallah murder. And the attack was aimed at three military bases in the Tel Aviv area, which are essential for any invasion of Lebanon. Now, when I first read about this, of course, all the media said, without any evidence, that these missiles were intercepted before they reached the ground. That is an enormous lie. Remember, the media is embedded there as well as in Ukraine. The Iranians say that while we are not seeking war, we are being threatened and surrounded, which is clearly true. They said this is just a glimpse of our capabilities. This is what Khamenei said, and they have they've admitted a large underground weapons cache within Lebanon. Then Jake Sullivan gets on the air. Again, I mentioned no context, no understanding. Jake Sullivan is the national security advisor, saying there will be severe consequences for this attack, and we will work with Israel to make that the case. As if this just occurs out of absolutely nowhere. Not that they have murdered, I mean, almost, you know, a huge portion over the last few years of the nuclear science establishment in Iran, civilian nuclear power establishment, has been murdered at one time or another. And when Sven was doing the show with me, if you remember, I said this has nothing to do with a military matter at all. The point is to render, you know, Iran as a first world country with all the benefits of being a first world country. Part of that is to be able to adjust to life when the oil runs out, or even when the West doesn't need as much anymore. Now, the U.S. doesn't get any oil from the Middle East, hasn't in a very, very long time, but the EU does. But this is a matter of long-term planning, and to destroy it, and to destroy its future, as they did in Iran, this is an economic attack, the essence of terrorism, since this is not a military matter whatsoever. Some of you may have seen videos of the Nevatim airbase. Despite the lies about all of these missiles being cut down, with what is a big question, by the way, that airbase has been severely damaged by this very competent barrage. The wreckage extends everywhere. There's all kinds of broken concrete, twisted rebar, wherever you go. So it's proven that Iran has the ability to strike very heavily defended installations. This is the capital of Israel. This is a serious matter. It's a simple matter of they can't believe this could happen because they still see Iran as a third world backwater. Syria was on the cusp of first world status before the 2010 demonstrations, which, by the way, went to Assad to a great extent. Assad was always fairly popular. Now poverty is about 85%, where it was a small percentage prior to 2010-2011. I mentioned the Nevatim air base. That's the location of 20 F-35s, American fighters. They seem to have all been, at least the bulk of them, have been destroyed in the attack. F-35 is a stealth fighter, a very high-value target. This is a very well-defended airbase, considered the most important, given what the F-35 is as far as the Israel's military capacity is concerned. They only have two squadrons of this. They're very expensive, and they rely on them very heavily. But destroying many, if not most, of these F-35s is important because they play a central role in any attack on Iran, any plans concerning an attack on Iran. They are the most advanced in terms of avionics, electronic warfare, air defense suppression features, etc. These are incredibly important assets. I don't know how many times on this show I've spoken of the U.S. simply running out of air defense missiles. These are millions of dollars each. Ukraine has burnt through them long ago to very, you know, limited effect. And there aren't that many left. Production is very difficult to get going again. And they're extremely expensive and difficult to use. So it's no surprise that this barrage was highly successful. It was simply an assumption of the media that it wasn't. And even the F-35, this was a skilled attack, a competent attack, and designed to defend Iran. There's a long delivery queue here for the F-35. There's a lot of problems with it, at least in the newer models. And Israel was slated only to receive the modified version only in 2028. After this, the enthusiasm, the murder of the Hezbollah leader faded away. The foreign minister, Yisrael Katz, said that the entire free world, of which they claim to be a member, had to support Israel. The Israelis simply assume that the West, at least the United States, and hence NATO, is going to support whatever Israel does. You know, that idiot Lindsey Graham is limping around, and he found a microphone. He said he wants his president in Washington to authorize attacks on oil refineries. I'm not so sure the U.S. has that capacity, or at least has that capacity and being able to withstand a counterattack. The U.S. has already failed to deal with the Yemenis, the Houthi, in these strategic areas concerning shipping to Israel, and I doubt they're going to be able to do much about this. This also means that Israel's air defense network is very limited. Again, we're not talking about an outlying area. We're talking about the capital. This is a highly sophisticated network equal to anyone. Maybe Taiwan would be an exception. There's a few reports that I came across that Netanyahu and a few others had to remain underground in a bunker somewhere near Jerusalem for hours. And so as of right now, this is the evening of the 2nd of October, the state of the Israeli Air Force is uncertain. And apparently almost the entire Nevatim air base was destroyed. Now at Hatzorim Air Base is where the F-15s are. There's also substantial losses reported there. They claimed it was minor, but unconfirmed losses too. At Ramat David Air Base, there's drones involved in that too. Not as intense as the Nevatim, but the fact that they were able to destroy this place goes far to what I've said about the U.S. simply running out of this missile, running out of the capacity. The Iranians, again, first world country, landed a direct hit on the Israeli gas platform off the coast of Gaza. And I'm proud to say that this was Chevron. They're the ones who operate the Tamar platform. I think it's about 20 miles off the coast of the Gaza Strip. This was what, at one point, the Israeli Supreme Court said does not belong to Israel. But given Netanyahu's so-called reforms, the Supreme Court doesn't have the importance that it used to. Even better, you're starting to see resistance for the first time since the foundation of Israel by the Soviets in 1948. You're getting resistance within the Pentagon itself. Now, I saw an article in Politico where you had private communications, senior White House officials, talking about the U.S. supporting the military pressure against Hezbollah, despite them trying to get Tel Aviv to curtail. But this shift to a wider war, the invasion of Lebanon, is not popular within the Pentagon itself. The decision to focus on Hezbollah rather than Hamas, which they have not destroyed after a year, you have people in intelligence saying that any move against Hezbollah, who is larger and better funded than Hamas, can drag American forces into yet another Middle East war. They're claiming that any confrontation directly between the IDF and Hezbollah may not go Israel's way. And all it's going to take is a huge battle to not go Israel's way, and the intense criticism of Israel will become an absolute avalanche. Now, whatever Israel does, it can be lain at the feet of the United States. The Protestant fundamentalists, the likes of these neocons, the Shapiro types, the U.S. is responsible for this. The U.S. will, in my opinion, destroy itself rather than abandon the Jews in Israel. And the general staff of the Iranian armed forces have been the only ones who can have any kind of celebration. The Iranians never, and they pointed this out, never initiated a war. And this is a matter of self-defense. Any retaliation against Iran has largely been harmed, vitiated. The Iranians are saying that they're going to widen their choice of targets, and the Iron Dome may simply not exist anymore. Is it possible that the Israelis will use a nuclear weapon against the Iranians? I think that's conceivable, but remember, Putin just had a conversation with Netanyahu. I think it was this week or late last week, where, you know, he tends to talk down to Netanyahu, saying that this will not be tolerated. Now, I read an article by Will Shriver, who apparently just has been in a coma for the last 15 years, because he's acting like he just discovered uranium in his backyard. He says, Russia, China, and Iran have now formed a de facto military and economic alliance. In the case of Russia and China, a comprehensive full-spectrum partnership has emerged. Military, economic, and monetary. Really? Like, I haven't been saying that since 2005. But it is true. Now, this must be new to him somehow. But both economically and militarily, the arms technology transfers among those three powers have been substantial. And then you include all members of the SCO, and possibly Turkey, when it's in the mood to do this, now India, maybe Pakistan, and many other states as well. But Shriver does say something new, that he does hold to the view that this trio, Russia, China, Iran, have come to the point where an attack on any one of them would constitute an attack on all of them. That means this is de facto the case, but he also thinks it's de jure the case. And they only have one goal, and that's dismantling the rule of liberalism, the Anglo-American Israeli Empire. In other words, any attack on Iran will automatically include Russia and China, and conceivably India and Pakistan. Today, as I've said 1,000 times, the liberal empire is stretched so thin that any potential it has for projecting itself militarily is heavily diluted. And they're not willing, at least as of right now, to risk the entire house of cards crumbling down. This is the harsh reality that the oligarchs are now facing. Of course, when it comes down to it, and the Iranians are not shy about this, connecting this to Nasrallah, the main reason that he was murdered had nothing to do with him being a terrorist. This is not a terrorist organization. This is a military force. But he was morally committed to saving Gaza by putting pressure on Israel. That's his sole purpose. This is what the UN Security Council tried to do before the U.S., of course, used its veto. Nasrallah refused to accept any diplomatic solution to end the fighting on the Israel-Lebanon border, or at least one that wasn't tied to an end to the war in Gaza. And the Israelis fully admitted this. Israel tried to reach a separate diplomatic solution with Hezbollah. Since this war began, knowing full well what a threat he could be, but Nasrallah rejected everything. There's an Israeli official, of course, anonymous, who says that what we found over the last 11 months is that Nasrallah is tying himself to whatever's going on in Gaza. He declined every diplomatic effort. He declined messages to stop connecting himself to the war in Gaza. His constant fire at Israel and his expansion of the range of and ferocity of the attacks against Israel, that's what led to him being murdered. Now, this comes from NBC. What he did, and this is the Zionist admission, is conduct a very precise intelligence-based strike against the headquarters of Hezbollah in Beirut. That's what the Israelis did to make sure that Nasrallah cannot be a decision-maker anymore. In other words, the man, by Israel's own admission, was a hero since he sacrificed his life for unarmed civilians in the occupied territories that cannot defend themselves. So, the timing of Iran's retaliatory strike clearly is connected with the ground phase of the Israel-Lebanon war. In fact, it was meant to deter a large-scale operation that could bring Gaza levels of destruction. Deter a Gaza-like war in Lebanon was the primary concern of the Iranians, to restore some kind of deterrence. Now, it's premature to say this, whether the military goals were met by the Iranians. Israel has not yet retaliated, although there's nothing to, they're the aggressors here. But the intensity of the damage put the brakes on Israeli plans in South Lebanon. Not to mention, worried about what further retaliatory acts from Iran might look like. Not to mention the fact that possibly Israel couldn't secure full blank check American support for its retaliation, although that has not harmed their plans before. But clearly the lies of the press concerning Iran's attacks have been exposed. The surge, this kind of violence, signifies the total failure, as Sergei Lavrov has said, of American policy in the region, going back to the Truman administration. Again, 181 ballistic missiles were fired, this doesn't include drones, at the Israeli state, although the initial claims were that it didn't matter and they were all intercepted. The Israeli military infrastructure received such damage that the Lebanon event has been scaled down, if not entirely postponed. And they're going to continue to do this. So there's this limited incursion into Lebanon. But Lavrov said, this bloody drama is just ramping up. Incoherent statements by White House demonstrate its total helplessness in resolving crises. Efforts by Anthony Blinken have led to thousands of casualties into a dead end. Now, it's true the U.S. has called for ceasefires, but this is largely a matter of a cover story. I don't know why people are still holding that the Gaza operation has only killed 45,000 Palestinians. That's ridiculous. It's much higher than that. It's a certain percentage of the, 2 million people who lived there before. And the point of it all is to make Gaza uninhabitable. This may be the plan for South Lebanon, too. So the population has to flee, no matter what. And Lavrov always has something important to say. And in fact, on the 28th of September, he addressed the UN General Assembly. He said, another blatant example of the use of terrorist methods to achieve political goals is the attack on Lebanon, in which civilian technology was turned to a deadly weapon. Now, of course, he's talking about the walkie-talkie thing. This crime must be investigated immediately. It's already impossible to ignore the numerous publications in the media, including in Europe and the USA, which prove the various levels of Washington's involvement and, at the very least, its awareness of the preparation of this terrorist attack. We understand that the Americans always deny everything and do their best to erase the emerging facts, just as they did in response to the irrefutable evidence of their involvement in the terrorist acts against the Nord Stream pipelines. These pipelines, by the way, are a great example of the global cooperation of which the UN Secretary General dreams. After their destruction, the competitiveness of the EU and the global economy has been undermined for many years to the benefit of the United States. This kind of thing is what you want from a foreign minister. Now, he did say a few stupid things. He said the October 7th attack from Hamas was a terrorist act without excuse, which is a blatant falsehood. But he spent most of the time excoriating Israel as an aspect of the U.S., or in the reverse. Israel likes excuses to attack people. Now, this one was a very good one, but it's a lot more than Tel Aviv can handle. Now, the limited incursion into Lebanon, damaged by the Iranian strike, I am coming across reports of major engagements between Israel and Hezbollah, ground engagements near the border region. The Lebanese militias have inflicted heavy casualties on the Israelis, using several large-scale ambushes. In fact, Israeli media reported a, quote, high casualty event near the border, and the evacuation of the wounded using at least four helicopters after an ambush. Many men were sent to Rambam Hospital nearby, and men on the ground have spoken admiringly almost of the sheer scale of Hezbollah's firepower directed against their forces. There were Israeli infantry trying to infiltrate from Adayase and Kfar Kela into Lebanon, which caused huge amounts of casualties. Hezbollah says that they thwarted this. There was a local media, Al-Mayadeen, reporting Hezbollah intelligence knew beforehand about this operation, of what the Israeli units were preparing, and this was the successful ambush. Now, I believe Hezbollah here because it's consistent with what they did in the failed 2006 Israeli offensive. A very similar situation. And Hezbollah then and now is capable of responding from directions that the IDF isn't prepared for. They go on to say that Hezbollah has targeted a large Israeli military force near the settlement of Maskavam with rockets and artillery, hitting, you know, not only accurately, but directly, and concentrations of Israeli forces in places like Shatula with two older Burkhan missiles with confirmed hits. So you have 2 days into this limited incursion into Lebanon, but because of the Iranian attacks and Hezbollah's own competence on the battlefield, their momentum is highly limited. The October 1st strikes did tremendous damage to Israeli capability on the battlefield. The fighter aircraft, both stealth and otherwise, that were destroyed, the F-35s, as I mentioned, and many F-15s, and also concentrating on ground forces, this has been a huge success. Something tells me that if you're going by the American press, you're not going to come across this. Now, the Israelis are talking about their own successes into Lebanon, but the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Mohammad Bagheri, said that the Israelis are using video from their previous incursions into the country, that these are not contemporary, that the Israelis were not able to send forces into Lebanon over the last few days, but their resistance fire was such that they were pinned down. And it's not just the Air Force, but the October 1st strikes did damage to the entire military infrastructure, which is why it was aimed at Tel Aviv. This, of course, is Operation True Promise 2. This is retaliation for the July 31st attacks in Tehran, as well as the murder of Nasrallah. Not to mention we're dealing with highly raised morale, and not just Hezbollah in Lebanon, but the Ansarullah coalition forces in Yemen, the Iraqi militias who are moving towards Lebanon now, and Hamas and Islamic Jihad, among many, many others. So, if anything, the murder of Nasrallah has backfired tremendously. But whatever Israel was planning on doing in Lebanon has been highly disrupted for a whole bunch of reasons. Again, the loss of the F-35s was a massive blow, not just in Iran, but anywhere else that they wanted to extend power, including Syria, and the exposure of the lack of air defenses and air defense missiles that Israel currently possesses. And Israel really is reliant on much older aeronautic systems. The F-35s were the vanguard of their power, and that seems to be gone. So this was a huge victory for the Iranians, and is one of the few pieces of good news here. However, regardless, whatever the media is saying, either is totally false or only contains a nugget of truth. But in the rest of the world, people are aware that the Anglo-Israeli alliance is increasingly a paper tiger. Hezbollah has been digging in, waiting for the Israelis to attack for a long time, even without Iranian assistance. Well, that's it for me, everyone. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.